session, finally you can find me there. And I think I should say some things to my context or my questions, because what will follow will rather be a theoretical and fairly naive in that essay, I would say. And I'm even more aware of my naivete now after these two wonderful papers in the session before and by Vincent and Eric, which touched on a somewhat similar terrain, but therefore it would, I think I have to clear what I'm asking for. And what interests me in the first place is, as I come from media studies, the relationship between sonic aesthetic practice and mostly, I would say, what you would call popular electronic music and media technology on the other side. And I say relationship and not influence, because this is something that is important to me, to not fall back in that old game called determinism, which is kind of hard in traditional media theory, to not, on the one hand, explain music as an aesthetic practice on the basis of the technological essence or something like that, which then determines all the rest, and all the rest becomes accident. Or to move on the other side, something like Axel Vollmar noted in his paper, to start with fixed groups, social groups, cultural groups, and then explain everything from that side, and everything else like becomes transparent. The technical side becomes transparent to that. And this is a question that I'm thinking a lot about. And in my Magister thesis, which I finished not so long ago, only last year, I therefore developed like an instrumentarium on the basis of the dispositif building, which is kind of often used in, at least in German media theory, but was not exactly what you would call a clear term to use. And this is something I did to follow the term in French theory, like from Michel Foucault and the film theory of Jean-Louis Bourdieu and Jean-François Lyotard, which will pop up later here. And now that this is kind of there, I want to expand on that term. And I'm looking for, I would say, with Eshun, I'm looking for new models to plug in my theoretical machine. And that was something that I stumbled upon, and that is what this paper is about me stumbling upon some theory by Karl-Heinz Stockhausen, who I'm no expert on at all, and stumbling upon the new book by Steve Goodman. And there some similarities popped up to me with Jean-François Lyotard's concept of the dispositif. And this is what I'm gonna read you about. Okay. Thinking about the connection between media theory and auditive culture, I'm not only interested in the question what media theory can actually tell us about the diverse fields of today's auditive cultural practices, that is, how have our concepts, as well as our uses and handlings of sound as an aesthetic material and as the cultural medium of science, changed since the introduction of media technologies, most notably phonography. But also in the inverse perspective, what can auditive experience contribute to model theories of media in the first place? As it is today commonly recognized, the mainstream of current approaches in media theory, as well as our everyday language, that was something that Jean-Paul Thibault noted earlier, is deeply interspersed with ocular-centric concepts of human perception. Still, it is all too often the transcendental subject of observer, installed by central perspective, that occupies, and in this case literally, the vanishing point of theoretical discussion. The modern self, as Stephen Connor has put it, and I quote him, constitutes itself in terms of the epistemological regime of the eye, which has become increasingly dominant in Western since the Renaissance. And it was, of course, one of the founding figures of media theory, Marshall McLuhan, who stated the next two concepts of visual space, derived from Renaissance perspective, it was also the media technologies of printing press, which further fueled an understanding of the pair as an atomistic subject. Seeing a world of definite separate objects lined up next to the other, all tied together by linearities of cause and effect. Finally, it was also Marshall McLuhan who proposed that the electronic media environments of today are better modeled as a kind of acoustic space, space that is not to be observed from a distance, but that inevitably surrounds us, that literally impresses on us from all directions simultaneously, a space that resonates. And I quote Eric Davis on this. Resonance can be seen as a form of causality, of course, but its causality is very different than that associated with visual space, because resonance allows things to respond to each other in a non-linear fashion. It is also this concept of resonance as a non-linear causality that is central to the following discussion of the relationship between media technologies, aesthetic practices, and theoretical discourses. Instead of reducing the entirety of cultural history to a predetermined symptom of the evolution of media technology, or vice versa, explaining the technological development as transparent as expression of free human will, one could also metaphorically assume that changes occurring in the media systems always hit certain critical frequencies, already existent, but perhaps masked in the field of practice and discourse, thereby amplifying certain bandwidths, which on their turn feed back into the resonating whole. Sometimes this may escalate in a screeching noise, hurting the eardrums of traditional aesthetics and established discourse. This is what could perhaps be said about cultural issues. But sometimes, on the other hand, this established discourse may be so loud that the irritating new frequencies may pass unheard. In the following, I want to shortly display two of these discursive events which resonate intensively with the ongoing disruptions in the sphere of transmedia. Both of them offer interesting alternative perspectives on sound, crucially alternating from the ways it is modeled, for example, in traditional musical discourse. The first example will be one of the pioneers of electronic music, Karlheinz Stockhausen, and his idea of a time continuum of musical composition which transcends fixed categories like pitch, timbre, or rhythm. As a second example, I will then touch on Steve Goodman's recent book, Sonic Warfare. Goodman, who is also known as one of dubstep's leading figures under the aegis of Code 9, develops a quite similar idea to Stockhausen when he thinks about the sonic as only a smaller part of a larger vibratory continuum. In both cases, it is not my goal to give a complete overview of these two accounts. It is rather, again, about figuring out certain frequency bands, leaving all the rest behind and mixing them together to make them resonate. Okay, Stockhausen. One of the central and guiding aesthetics assumptions of electronische Musik since the 1950s has been to think of musical composition as taking place in a time continuum. Instead of taking the concepts of timbre, pitch, rhythm, and form as qualitatively discrete musical categories, as classic compositional theory treated them for ages, the composers in the electronic studios understood them rather as varying, sometimes overlapping bandwidths on the central continuum of sound. As pioneer Karlheinz Stockhausen explains, and I quote, "I suppose the difference in acoustic perception could all be put down to differences in tiny structures of vibration." End quote. And as he sets out elsewhere, this implies that the previously apparently distinct categories of musical perception and production, timbre, melody, harmony, length of notes, and form, become discernible as marking only different sections on a wider continuum of sound, or more exact, of vibrations. And that one can finally skip from one category to the other. And with regards to time, we will skip the next section. I think we all know that certain frequencies under between 10 and 20 hertz are no longer heard as a constant pitch level, but are heard as a rhythmic frequency. And Stockhausen divided this vibratory continuum that he explained into four parts, which would be the rhythmic frequencies, then from about different timescales of music, which go from mathematically ideal infinitesimal to the infinite. Okay, so what is crucial about this, the boundaries of these timescales are, as Vogt points out, sometimes clearly marked and sometimes don't, of rather continuous shifts of perception. But in either case, they are only present in human perception, not in the quality, of the vibration as such. And I quote Vogt, a sound passes from one timescale to another because of perceptual boundaries. It seems to change quality. This is because human perception processes each timescale differently. The practical and statistic consequence of this shift of perspective, which seems more or less abstract at first, is perhaps best exemplified by taking a completely simplified look at one of the basic compositional techniques of Stockhausen. In his early works, namely Kontakte, he was no longer satisfied composing with instrumental sounds defined and limited by the structures of traditions of instrument designs. So he went over to composing individual vibrations out of sequences of technically generated impulses recorded onto a tape machine. For example, when he created a sequence of impulses by the speed of 90 beats per minute, which would equal 1.5 hertz, this was at first perceived as a rhythmical structure. But the same sequence copied onto an endless tape loop and sped up by the factor of 128, which would equal a transposition by 7 octaves, results in a continuous tone with a recognizable pitch of 192 hertz, which would then be somewhere between fis and G. This basic principle allowed the composer to shape and form the actual sounds at the stage of rhythmical organization of impulses, and then afterwards transpose it with the structure to get a continuous tone, which pitch level is identified by the longer periodical structures of impulses, whereas smaller variations within these periods make up the timbre. The resulting self-composed tones and sounds could then finally, in a little cut-and-paste operation, be arranged at the macro time scale of the musical form. Now, what is crucial about Stockhausen's concept of sound as a time continuum here is the fact that this continuum is inseparably interwoven with the media technologies of analog and later digital phonography. Not for Stockhausen, of course, with the digital. After all, it is the ability to record sound as a vibration event, either by transforming the time structure of the vibrations into a material structure carved into the grooves of the phonograph record, by translating the vibrations of air pressure into such a voltage modulated on the magnetic tape, or finally by chopping up the vibrations into discrete samples represented in binary code, which precedes the thought of a sound event as something that can be accelerated or decelerated as such, and therefore transposed within the time continuum. As Friedrich Kittler has argued, it is one of the central qualities of media to enable such time-axis manipulation. And Stockhausen himself admits that it is electronic media in the first place, which renders the composition within the time continuum possible, when he writes, "So under the circumstances, we had a whole continuum at our disposal, which is to achieve only through the new apparatus within which we can continually pass from one part to the next." It's not my point here to declare Stockhausen's work as a merely byproduct of the evolution of media technology, which would then lead back into crude determinism. I would rather argue that changes and alterations of technical means and artistic practice always shatter the established aesthetic discourses and as such give rise to new forms of knowledge and discourse as well as new forms of aesthetic practice. So instead of exploring the media as a somewhat last solid ground, which helps to explain both subjective behavior as well as historic practice, I understand it as being always embedded in heterogeneous networks of specific discourses and practices, tied to specific complexes of knowledge, which altogether bring about certain always ambiguous effects. In short, I do not want to look at the media as the often cited a priori, but using a term which has its origins in the French philosophy and film theory as a dispositif of today's experience in the agent of experience and agency. I will discuss this further in a minute, but first we should take a look at another one of such discursive disruptions. About half a century after Stockhausen first developed this idea of composition in a time continuum, British theorist Steve Goodman thought about sound, about different biotechnical, social, cultural, artistic, conceptual technologies of sound, and that was a quote, and their use as weapons in an effective war waging on the central battlefields of today's multimedia environments. this book, Sonic Warfare, Sound Effect and the Ecology of Fear, published earlier this year, Goodman examines the diverse shapes of acoustic violence of vibration, the militarization of the audiosphere. From the battlefields of the World Wars, its sonic military equipment, like the vocoder, for instance, and the Italian futurist's praise of the art of, again, mostly war, noise, he reproduces these micropolitics of sound and up to contemporary uses of acoustic devices for crowd control in Europe's inner cities, of the sonic booms deafening the Gaza Strip. Finally, to the vibrational counter strategies of pirate radio stations taking over the airwaves of the vertical slums, and that's a term by Ned Fuller, of today's public housing project, or the nucleus of an artificial aesthetic described by Kosuke Eshun over 10 years ago, the future with the machine. All this highly interesting and important comments on these ongoing battles, ceases firing, of effect time set aside, Goodman aims to develop nothing less than a non-representational ontology of vibrational force. And I would say that this big term ontology is somewhat misleading at this point, but because one could say that what he does with it is rather a strategy of deontologization, of de-essentialization, but nevertheless. A trembling philosophy that is heavily shaken by the reverberations of the subtle frequency produced by the heart, sharp, high-pitched tones of today's sonic hyper-reality. Such a philosophy, then, would no longer model the world as deeply oculocentric Cartesian time-space, inhabited by definite objects and observed and known by seeing subjects, but would rather describe it as a vibratory continuum of matter, and that's a nice term by Goodman, where all such seemingly solid instances, like subjects or objects, finally appear only as unstable and momentary products, cut out by the narrow boundaries of human perceptions. And I quote, if you subtract human perception, everything moves. Anything static is so only at the level of perceptibility. Instead of talking about fixed subjects and objects, Goodman, with regards to Spinoza, as well as Deleuze and Guattari, and Bachelard and Lefebvre and others, grounds his analysis in the concept of an all-encompassing kinetic field of restlessly vibrating particles, out of which individuated bodies only emerge depending on their relationship of speeds and slownesses. According to Gilles Deleuze, the body thereby can be anything, and that's a quote, a body of sounds, it can be a linguistic corpus, a social body, a collectivity, end of quote. Each body is itself made up from other bodies, partial organs, which altogether form not merely a closed determinant system, but rather an always provisional and fragile entity, tied together primarily by the rhythmic consistency and effective potential. And we heard about that in the paper. For Goodman, it is not only about opening up fixed musicological categories like pitch or rhythm into the time continuum of sound, but sound itself is becomes only one sensory modality, one way to affect and be affected by an always rumbling, vibrating environment. The world becomes a vibratory discontinuum. By zooming in on the fundamental level of vibration which precedes all seemingly stable instances like things or persons, humans or technologies, Goodman addresses three major problems which he sees in most academic discourse about sonic phenomena. First of all, the sonic is free from linguistic imperialism, which always tries to decode a meaning and script into the sounds, thereby leaving behind the asemantic, material, the crucially effective dimension of sound. Secondly, the physicist assumption is countered that all sonic phenomena can be accurately measured, and I would say explained from the physics of acoustics. Instead, the relationist perspective is adopted, which focuses on sound as incorporeal effects, as an encounter of bodies affecting other bodies. And finally, the shift in perspective always away from the central hearing human subject to a broader view of complex networks of interrelated entities, leaves behind the phenomenological anthropocentrism of almost all musical and sonic analysis, thereby clearing the site to take all the non-human participants into analysis which play their parts well. It's right at this point that the hardware parts, the vast setups of sonic media technology, enter the stage of a vibrational ontology. Similar to arguments recently made by ectonetic theory, short-circuited explanations can then be rejected which treat media technologies either as always available, possible, the passive means of subjective human agency, or on the other hand, as subjects themselves driving socio biological process, reducing the human to a mere servo mechanism. Instead of that, humans and non-humans, organic as well as technological bodies, are wired together in a complex network, a resonating whole, as specific actors, or in this case perhaps oscillators, each equally important for an adequate theoretical analysis. So rather than conceptualizing media devices as more or less transparent channels of communication, as memory banks holding some kind of content independent of the media itself, they become visible, or rather audible, as self-contained actors themselves, resonating and thereby changing and rechanneling the entire biological field. With Goodman, we can now reconceptualize media technologies as integral parts of, and I quote, sound systems, consisting of bodies, technologies, and acoustic vibrations, all in rhythmic sympathy. Here, in this last point, we'll bring these considerations to a close. Some similarities become visible between the concept of media technologies as parts of larger sound systems and the theoretical term of a media dispositive. To treat media as parts of a specific dispositive always means to neglect any essential effects inherent in the media as such, and to rather deduce any effects from a spawning of practice and discourse which surrounds any media device. After a famous quote by Michel Foucault, the dispositif is a crucial heterogeneous ensemble built up from discourse, institutions, architectural facilities, and so on, always processing and reinstalling a specific complex of knowledge and power. On the other hand, there has been a strain in film theory since the 70s, most notably Jean-Louis Baudry, that talks of the cinema dispositif pointing at the unique assemblage of a hidden projector, the dark hall, and the fixed spectator. But for these remarks here, a third member of the long line of France's great thinkers is of even more interest, and that would be Jean-François Lyotard. For Lyotard, a dispositif means all kind of apparatus that regulates the circulation of energy within aesthetic practice. Writing mostly about painting, he declares that, and I quote, the dispositif is a diagram who channels and regulates the energy, its supply and removal as chromatic inscription, end of quote. Hence, the dispositif implies both the material as well as the ideal conditions under which the aesthetic processes proceed, the aesthetic strategy as well as the technological environment. It is primarily at this notion of Lyotard's dispositif as an energetic control circuit that it could potentially be linked up to concept of a vibratory continuum. It could then leave the unresolvable dichotomy between music as a meaningful cultural medium of organized noise or something like that, and the seemingly accidental technical means of its production, distribution, and reception behind, and instead focus on a vibratory field of possible sound that is steadily opened up and restructured by a dispositif made from a heterogeneous array of aesthetic discourses and practice, technical means, and corresponding complexes of knowledge. To put it in a somewhat Deleuze-Spinozist dictum, media dispositifs change the way in which the human body affects and can be affected by sonic vibrations. According to Lyotard, each dispositif is characterized by a set of specific limitations which regulate flows of energy within aesthetic practice and which especially charge certain objects or certain sensory modalities.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Put another way, one could say that the affected potential distributed on the vibratory continuum that is continuously remapped, not by media technology alone, but by the entire surrounding proliferation of cultural discourses, practice, and knowledge. So, skip that, and we will end with one last category, because in the end, it would be our own position as subjects within this world that had to be reconceptualized in the face of the theory of a media dispositif. A dispositif is not to be understood as a kind of fixed frame which limits and restricts the acts of a free, independent subject, but rather as the ground on which every subjective acting proceeds, on which subjectivity is produced at first. Hence, we can finally go back to the beginning, because it is precisely this fragility, this provisionality of our experience as subjects, that a media theory still focused on the transcendental subject observer could perhaps best learn from auditive culture. Karl-Heinz Stockhausen beautifully concludes these remarks on sound, on sound as something that affects and is affected rather as something that needs something else. And he sounds almost like Deleuze when he says, if somebody experiences something acoustic, he gets changed. Since he is modulated by the vibrations, all these atoms get modulated. Only partially can you recover the state in which they vibrated before.
I think there's a reason why the notion of the dispositive has not been used so much in the last 25 years. Something happened around 1980. And you should dive into this, why this is the case. But you mentioned actor network theory, and I think the network and the dispositive, you should work out where's the difference here, and also the field metaphor. So that's basically the difference between the dispositive and the network. Why the network is, for instance, a different kind of concept, and but also criticize, and maybe why we have to reenact the dispositive notion, because I think that's also acoustic. You know, you have, you know, the impact of the notion of the dispositive, and then the rejection. And I think maybe it's time now to come back into the middle to take it up, because it's I think it's. We need this to be critical. I think that's what you want to do.
Yeah, of course, this was far too short to sketch this term, or to of course criticize this term of the disability. But I think there's still something in it, and that could be a clue from the theory.
Yes, and I didn't mean critical about the notion of the disability, but to take the disability to be critical to do your work.
Yeah.
We have another question.
Yes. Well, I have a question. I heard a strange statement.
Oh.
Resonance is a nonlinear causality. You
this
were
was completely metaphorical.
But you can't make a metaphor that is utter nonsense. But who was it? It was
Eric Davis.
Oh,
it was
sorry.
Called Eric Davis.
Yes.
Eric Davis.
Yes.
That's a quite shameless text I think, which is called the acoustic cyberspace, where the code is from.
No,
I think so.
Why do you think it's nonsense? I mean,
because resonance is linear. It's absolutely linear. I mean, it's the activation of the circuit, of a linear circuit, and if you have the proper frequency, which corresponds to its eigenfrequency, as they sometimes say.
Oh, in technical sense.
Yes, in technical sense, then you will have a resonance. And the losses will determine how high it is. And in practice, practical life, there's always a limit to how resonance is. It can be limited then by non-linearities, of course, but just to blatantly say resonance is a non-linear causality, is wrong.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I mean, well, many of the things that you brought up resonate either linear or non-linear with many of the things that I'm interested in, so I'm really interested in your paper. But I have a question. I don't know whether or not you're familiar with the Deleuzean notions of diagram.
Only in relation to that he thought of what in his work on Foucault, that he took the kind of further the Foucaultian dispositive thing, and he took this further into the diagram.
Yeah, because I would like to ask you what the difference or perhaps the similarities between the dispositive that Lyotard talks about and the notion of the diagram, and how these two relates.
That's really interesting, and I haven't quite an answer on that. But,
they are in a sense similar, or at least they are related in some sense. Because I'm not that familiar with the notion of dispositive, so that's why.
In the sense that Lyotard's notion is really like you would say energetic, and he talks a lot about intensities,
mm-hmm.
which you said could be translating into effects, and far, I think the dispositif is a term to criticize the limitations of aesthetic practice, and he wants to get all the walls down. It is a different approach than the Deleuze, because it is really focused on this in more practice, and that.